Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Chelsea Bond with Let's Talk.
Thank you for joining Let's Talk. I would like to acknowledge the Turrbal and Yuggera people on whose land in which we are situated today, and I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land in which you sit on today. I'd like to acknowledge our elders, both past and present, Indigenous and non-Indigenous. Today's Let's Talk is a special segment I'm introducing each month, profiling an Indigenous PhD candidate. When I first joined this show and I yarned with Carver about the work that I do as an Indigenous academic, I spoke to him about how excited I was to see the emerging Indigenous scholarship and the number of Indigenous peoples who are doing a PhD and pursuing academic careers. And what I thought I'd do is each month profile an Indigenous PhD student to share with you the work they're doing and why they're doing it. And I guess we often think of academics as being in these ivory towers, out of touch with the real world. And what excites me about our Indigenous scholars that are coming through is there is a real desire to bring Indigenous knowledges into the academy, to contest the knowledges that have been produced about us. Over the next few months, you're going to meet some Indigenous students who are doing awesome work in the academy, but bringing their mob with them. And today we are very, very privileged to have Miss Tara Lewis, who I have to confess is one of my PhD students, who's going to talk about what she's doing and why she's doing it. Welcome to the show, Tara.
Thank you.
But before we talk things about PhDs and all that stuff, and we'll explain what a PhD is as part of this, tell us about your mob, where you come from, and a bit about what you do.
Yep. So I grew up on Yuggera country, been here my whole life, Brizzy. So I haven't gone very far.
Bless.
I spent a lot of my childhood in Quinton Street, Kapalawa, with the Kapalawa Doyles.
Oh.
So my mum's a white woman. Mm-hmm. I grew up with her and her best friend, my Auntie Elsa. She married my dad's cousin, and they're like cousin brothers, so they're very close, very connected. So I spent a lot of my childhood roaming around with the Kapalawa Doyles out that way. My mum was really instrumental in making sure that I knew who I was. I was grounded, knew my culture, my Aboriginal heritage, etc. And my dad's been really important in continuing that on for me to learn about, you know, our ways of knowing, being and doing and who we are and where we're connected. So on my dad's side, my grandfather is Iman, so we are Iman Nation, up Taroom Way, Central Queensland, and my grandmother's side, we have connections with Yarrawa country, so Ipswich, Bunya region.
Mm. And you got a family?
I do. I've got three little kids. They keep me very busy. So I got Jackson, who's 7, and Ashton, 5, and Holly's 2. And she rules the place.
Yes, as she should. And now you're a speech pathologist.
Yes.
What does a speech pathologist do? I'm scared now because I'm worried that you might be assessing my speech.
Not at all. Well, I think in essence, and I say think because I probably should know what a speech does, but other people might have different opinions. But we support people who might have some communication difficulties, so we support people to communicate in everyday life. So where I work at the Institute for Urban Indigenous Health, and I work with Little E's. So I'm a paediatric speechy, and I support kids who might have some difficulties being understood.
So what age is Little E's in for paediatric speechy?
Well,
mouthful.
I like 0 to 5. But I've got to work, obviously, with older kids as well, and they're fun too. So 0 to, 16 is what we work up to usually.
This is a really silly question, but how do you work out speech difficulties with zero to one, or like what's...
Yeah, so I guess by look, we're looking, we're not just looking at speech. So speech looks at language as well. So we're looking at how well kids can understand you, how well they communicate with you. So kids are communicating non-verbally by the time they're one. You know, oh. So throughout that period, they're looking at you, they're reaching for things, they're laughing. So that's all that communication that we're looking for when they're little. And I guess if they're not, then they're kind of red flags that there could be something going on, so you want to catch them early.
Wow. So how do you get referred to, like when you see new clients, is it via the like GP or health service or through the hospital, or what's the...
Yeah, so I work out of the Murray Services, Aboriginal Medical Services throughout Brisbane and you know, southeast Queensland. So we get our GP referrals. That's how the kids come to us.
Okay.
Yes, yeah.
Now, how long have you been a speechie?
Oh, a long time. 15, maybe?
Really?
15 years, yeah.
So how old are you? 15
years.
Yeah,
I look so young.
And why did you become a speech pathologist? Like, when did you go straight to uni from high school? What was your journey into career in speech pathology?
Yeah, so I went straight to uni from school. So I don't remember thinking, you know, I was going to be a speech pathologist, whatever. I think I wanted to be a physio, wanted to work in the sports area.
Oh, okay.
But I had some nephews and nieces and cousins with some speech difficulties. So Mum just said to me, well, what about a speechie? And I thought, oh, yeah, I could give that a go.
As you so, do, yeah.
Right. So I didn't get into speech straight up. You know, you did an OP3. I don't even know what it is now, so
oh,
I need
please.
Those big OPs.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a year of social work first and then got the scores that I needed and then went into speech.
Well, we were just talking this week with Nat Fraser at UQ's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies Unit.
Yep.
And she was talking to students about that pathway options. If you don't have the OP score that you need, you can do it 1 year of another degree to get in.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So that would have been a bit of a shift going from doing first-year social work into speech pathology?
Yeah, it was. So I guess speech, you've got all that anatomy and physiology, social work, you're coming from, you know, the psychology perspective. So it was a big shift.
Mm.
It was a bit tricky at first, I think, but I think that first year really gave me an insight and understanding around what uni life will be like,
yeah.
Which I think was handy. Because coming in from school, you know, you got all your friends around you. Going into uni, you got no one.
Mm.
And I know you and I were talking about that just a couple of days ago. So I think that year was probably really beneficial for me. And then going into speech and knowing, being able to navigate the system probably a bit better.
Yeah. And you've also had your own business around your speech pathology practice. Can you tell us about that? And
yeah. So not straight up. So I went out to Billawheeler the first year I graduated and then came back because I got my proposed, so thought I'd better come home, get married.
Oh, you come home to get married?
Yes.
What, did you meet your man at Billawheeler?
No. He was here. So Adam and I, we've known each other since preschool. So known each other a long time.
Wow.
Known our families for a long time.
Wow.
But I think just going away, you know, he just...
Did he come to Billawheeler with you?
He would visit, so he'd come visit all the time.
Oh, did you have, like, a placement thing post graduating? Like, you had to go to, a rural placement thing?
Yeah, so I got a scholarship, a rural scholarship. So I was supposed to be out there for 2 years, but no good. Okay, just went there for 1 year and then came home.
I had one of those too. So I got a 2-year rural health scholarship with Queensland
same
Health.
One. Yeah, same one.
Because I wanted to go to some really far-off exotic location because, you know, you're idealistic and I'm going to travel. And no good. They sent me to Dolby, which was, you know, three hours. It's awesome. I love Dolby. Shout out to Dolby mob out there. They're my family. But I was dating my husband at the time then, and when I had to go to my placement, I was like, oh, you're going to move or, you know, do the long-distance relationship thing? And he's like, yeah, well, I'm not going to follow no woman, you know, how he goes. It took him 2 months. He had moved out there because the phone bills were just ridiculous. When you row on the phone, it costs a lot of money. So we thought it was more economical.
Yeah.
So, no, he ended up following. But I had the same thing, rural health scholarship,
yep.
And we came back to get to Brisbane and got married. Yeah.
See what happens?
Wow, hey?
But yeah, so I came back, and then I was working with Queensland Health with the Indigenous Ear Health Program, Hearing Health Program.
Okay.
So I was always
that's
working.
That's not deadly ears, that's a different one.
Different one, yeah, yep. So this was on the south side mm-hmm. of Brisbane. Deadly ears they do central and north. I think okay. they do their statewide program now too, which is good. But we were just working in the urban setting in Brisbane, so working out of Mount Gravatt and seeing kids across the urban setting at the Hearing Health Program. So, yes, I worked there forever. So, and I've always been working with our kids, with our Murray
okay,
ones.
Yeah.
So I think the practices that we were using in speech didn't really work for our kids. Yeah.
So you've worked in mainstream clinics and Indigenous-specific clinics, but always having, you know, mob, of course, accessing the services.
Yep.
Wow. And so could I asked you about your business.
Oh, yeah.
Well, tell me about your business.
So, I went into business with my private practice called All About Speech. So I was seeing all private. This is after I had kids, so I thought, you know, might be a bit easier just to have your own business and whilst you got kids, don't know how, but anyway. Mm. So All About Speech, so I was seeing private clients, but I'd get a lot of referrals through the GPs and the health services too, so
right.
And I'd bulk bill our Murray kids that came through the door,
yeah,
just for, you know, easier access, just to support that whole access concerns that are around accessing private health practitioners.
Yep, not a lot of them have got private cover for this stuff. Yeah,
that's it. It's so expensive too. You want to pay $250 for an initial assessment
mm-hmm.
and then you got to pay $75, $80 for a half-hour session each week. So.
And it's like there's usually a sort of a long waiting list for people to get access to a speech pathologist through the public system?
Public it is, yeah, big time. So we'd have 2 years at Queensland Health. To get on the
wow.
system.
Yeah, when so you think about these early years and...
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So by the time you realise that your child might have some difficulties, then it's probably too late because once they hit school, then Queensland Health will just close your books. They might see you for an assessment, but then close the books because you're supposed to be seen by the Education Queensland Speechies then.
Mm.
Yeah. But, yeah, through my practice, you know, I just changed the way that we assess kids because the standardised assessments that we use... as speechies, don't look at the way that Aboriginal people communicate and Aboriginal kids communicate. So I just changed the way that we did things through my practice and developed up an assessment called GAMERI. So that looks at Aboriginal ways of communicating and supports home language use rather than expecting our kids to be speaking standard Australian English.
Mm, interesting. So do you think that... with, you know, the sort of mainstream sort of assessment methodology that our kids are being overdiagnosed with speech communication issues or what's your...
Yeah, I think so, big time. So when I first started out, one of my friends, Judy Gould, she's a speechy down Murray Bridgeway in Adelaide, and mm-hmm. so she gave me a call and she was doing her PhD at the time and she said, you know, look, this community that I'm working at, half the kids are diagnosed with speech-language impairment or intellectual impairment when they're not, you know, in a community, you're speaking different language, much different to urban space. You know, urban space, we still have our language. We still speak our home language. But it just was overlooked in this community. And she said, you know, we've got to do something about it. And so then she went and she did some assessments looking at Aboriginal ways of communicating, and I've kind of continued down that path as well. It's because the assessments that are used don't look at, you know, the way that our kids speak and our mob speak. They're expecting us to speak standard Australian English. And, you know, when you're with mob, you don't speak standard Australian English. Mm. And when you come into school after 5 years of yarning up with your family... then there's this real expectation that you'll be speaking Australian English straight up in the classroom when that's not necessarily the case.
Interesting. What do you say to people who say, well, look, all Australian kids should be speaking standard Australian English and, you know, what do you say to that? Do you think all kids should be speaking standard Australian English and have a certain standard of which they must adhere to or comply with? Or, you know, does it have links with educational outcomes and things like that?
Yeah, so as a speechy, you're taught that, you know, it's really vital in those early years to be to have a really good language model. And I guess the language model that is really good system-wise is Standard Australian English. So I guess once they hit school and they don't have that broad range of Standard Australian English in terms of understanding and talking, the instruction in the classroom then is Standard Australian English. So I guess the idea is that the kids will fall behind because they're not used to hearing that or speaking that at home.
Mm-hmm.
But when we talk to Mob, it's really important to keep language alive. You know, we talk about mission days. My family always talk about how they weren't allowed to speak language, how language was lost.
Mm.
But I guess language wasn't really lost. Well, through the stories that, you know, family tell me, language was oppressed and it was stolen. So I think it's really important for what I've heard from many other Aboriginal people is that it's important to keep language alive and to teach our kids language. But on the other hand, they're also saying that they need to speak Standard Australian English to succeed in life, and that's through education and getting a job.
Mm. When you talk about home language, what do you mean? Is it about speaking...
Proper way?
Can you tell us about when you say home language, what does that mean? Because people think about languages other than English as being speaking fluently in another language that is not understood. But home language means something different in this instance, doesn't it?
Yeah. So a lot of people think about traditional Aboriginal languages, and there's lots of revitalisation around traditional Aboriginal languages, which is fantastic, which is what we need. But there's also that idea of, you know, colonisation and what colonisation, how that has informed the different languages used today. You know, all Mob being brought to missions and then having to communicate using different languages has created what a linguist call this emergency language.
Emergency language. Wow, it sounds alarming.
I know, right? But it's a way for people to communicate. So you got, you know, top-end Queensland talking to bottom-end Queensland and everywhere. So they've got to have this emergency language like a pigeon.
Mm.
And so then what happens is when you have babies and they're born into this pidgin language, it becomes their first language, so it becomes a language then. And so what linguists call it is called Aboriginal English.
Okay.
So English words with Aboriginal language words, different meanings around that. Like, you know, we use words like bullyman or gunji, deadly.
Gammon.
See there. So when we use those words with English ways of using words too, then it's... That's what I call as home language, which is really prevalent in an urban space.
Yeah, I find it interesting when people talk about Indigenous language loss. And I remember when I was doing some interviews at Inala, and there was a few other research projects I'd worked on where we recorded people and sent it off the recorded interviews to transcribers, most of which were non-Indigenous people. And it was so fascinating. We had to read back through the transcripts and get corrections done because the transcribers were changing the words to make it read properly. And sometimes it changed the meaning, or they couldn't decipher the Aboriginal English words and it didn't make sense for them, so they made it to a word they thought it should be. Couldn't pick up on the accents, and this is, you know, Brisbane. I remember yarning with people about language and Mob sat talking about language loss. And then you read them transcripts and you go, there are language words everywhere. The sequencing of words is different. You know, what time is it? What time it is?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's... living out at Dalby and Maunganui Mob, they speak differently. Sherberg Mob speak differently. Nala Mob got own lingo there that's unique to a Nala. Warri, you know, you can tell when you listen to people that, oh, they must come from that place, hey?
Yeah.
Like,
that's it.
So language is still alive.
It's definitely still alive, yeah.
It's
and
a
I
bit
think
different.
We hold on to it too.
Mm.
It's part of identity and that group belonging too, I think. But, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because when I'm talking to Mob and with my work as well, that we talk about language being lost, but when you listen to the stories, then it's really that the language has been taken away, has been stolen from us.
Mm.
And so that real And I think it just shows the resilience of our elders and our family with everything that has happened and what we've all gone through,
yeah.
That language is still alive. It hasn't been lost. It hasn't been stolen completely. Traditional languages, yeah, because nothing was written down, you know, white ways of recording.
Yeah.
And we weren't allowed to. Like my grandmother, she never spoke language.
Mm.
And I don't know if it was because the past was too horrific
mm.
or because she was still trying to protect us all. Because, you know, back in the day, you couldn't speak language.
Mm.
And she would say to my auntie, oh, don't be silly, we can't talk like that.
Mm.
And my uncle will talk about mission days where, you know, if he spoke language, if they got caught speaking language, they'll get locked up.
Yeah.
So you've got all them stories about language.
So when you hear some of the contemporary debates, and particularly I think this was going back a few years ago, I think when John Howard was PM and looking at, you know, education in schools in the Northern Territory, and there was a whole sort of thing going around making sure that children are learning in English and they shouldn't be learning in their own language and all this kind of stuff. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's tricky. If a child comes in and English isn't their first language, then how are they going to understand it?
Mm.
How can they keep learning and succeed in this modern world? I think we need to be supporting children through their home language and building upon that, because if we're just saying English and that's it, then it goes back to mission days, doesn't it, where we're mm. still, language is still oppressed and there's yep. still that power where English is proper language and anything else isn't
yeah up to standard.
Yeah, that's
so there's
right.
this kind of interesting hierarchical arrangement that standard Australian English is the norm of which others must comply with, and anything other is problematic.
Yeah. But when you go back to community, well, when you go to family, you got to speak proper way with family.
Because they're only going to pull you up if you speak in German way.
That's yes. right. Yes. And there's research out there too. I've read some papers that say that they can't go back to community and speak, you know, English or, you know, university talk. They've got to go back and talk proper way with family.
Mm. So we're saying proper a lot here, but when we're saying proper our way, it's P-R-O-P-P-A.
That's it.
Not
yeah.
proper.
No.
Proper.
But you listen to some of our elders, eh? Like, they speak that proper English way.
Yeah.
How they've been taught in missions.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that is real proper, and you can see how they've had that instruction in missions too, which is real deadly for them too.
Yeah.
So, no, it's interesting, isn't it?
It is. Now, we're going to take a break, and we're going to, when we come back, talk about this PhD.
You're tuned to Let's Talk, a weekly current affair program hosted by First Nations people for First Nations peoples. This is Chelsea Bond with Let's Talk.
Thank you for joining us on Let's Talk today. Today's show, we are profiling Indigenous PhD student Tara Lewis, who is enrolled with the School of Rehab Sciences at the University of Queensland. So, Tara, you're a speech pathologist and you've gone on this journey to do a PhD. Why?
Exactly.
Sometimes. Are you asking yourself that now? Yeah,
yeah, I do every day. Sometimes I think I'm real womba. But, I don't know. It took a long time, I think, for me to say I'll enrol in the PhD and do the PhD. Like, I'm not a person really for red tape, and I think a PhD is all that red tape where you've got to do all this writing, you've got to have all, you know, proper way of doing things. And it's not about the end result of those letters with your name either. It's always been about the kids that I see. You know, I spoke earlier about a lot of our kids being diagnosed with speech language impairment or intellectual impairment, and I think that's what drives me. I want our kids to have the same opportunities as every other kid in this country.
Mm.
And if we're not looking at and valuing the way that our kids come to school or with their home language and valuing culture around that, then I don't think, you know, we can succeed as much as what we should be able to.
Mm.
So I think me doing the PhD is around around informing other speech pathologists about what Aboriginal people value around communication
mm.
and how we communicate with each other and why it's important to maintain that and why it's important to change what we currently do and what we're currently taught at uni to make sure that we value you know, the Aboriginal kids that walk into our clinics.
So for the listeners, a PhD is a postgraduate degree, and it's a research degree where you spend 3 years, sometimes four or a bit more, depending how traumatic the experience is, where you do an independent research project that you develop yourself and do under the supervision of academics who then meet with you and discuss and give you feedback. The research question that you're asking with your research or statement you're making, can you tell us about that? So what are you doing as part of this?
Yep. So I'm looking at a culturally responsive methodology. So I'm looking at the way that we assess kids and trying to make it more appropriate for our kids. So the standardised assessments that we use now are very rigid and very structured, which don't go the way that, you know, Aboriginal people communicate with each other. So I'm looking at that methodology, looking at what speech pathologists value around communication, what Aboriginal people value around communication, trying to bring that together somehow to create this new methodology, so a new system, a new way of doing things.
Wow. So you're going to, at the end of this, develop a way in which is a more appropriate way to assess Indigenous kids' speech communication abilities.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Hopefully.
Yeah. So, and you've started, you're in the middle of your research and you've done, you've started interviewing speech pathologists and Indigenous community members about communication and what they value. Can you tell us about what you've done and what you've found? Can you tell us what you've found so far?
I can tell you a little bit.
You mean a sneak peek?
So I've run some focus groups with speechies and asked them, you know, what's important to them when communicating. And also with some Murray community members too, spoken about what they value around communication. And I think the speech is, I think what we value around communication can get lost in when we're assessing
We're
seeing kids.
What do you mean by that?
Oh, what do you see as important when you're communicating? I'll put it back on you, Chelsea.
Oh, here, I'm supposed to be asking the questions. Relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So when you go
out... Who I'm talking to and how that tells me how I've got to talk to someone and the rules around that and doing that proper way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. And, you know, a lot of the Aboriginal groups that are the people that I've interviewed had said the same thing. It's about that connection.
Mm.
It's about the relationships. It's about the stories and the learning through the stories. And so when I've interviewed the speeches, I think that overarching idea of communication where it is you go and catch up with someone and you see how they're going and you have that those emotions and those feelings with the people that you're connecting with, I think that gets lost. Because the speeches we're taught about breaking communication into certain parts. So we're looking at speech, we're looking at language, we're looking at the voice quality, we're looking at the fluency rate if they're stuttering.
Oh, wow.
Looking at all of that type of stuff. And so then you break that down even more. So the speech, you look at their speech sounds. With the language, you look at can they get their message across? Can they understand you? So you're looking at all those core components of what communication is. Where and the true part of communication might get lost within that assessment.
Because, I mean, thinking about this idea of this communication in these parts, if just looking at those parts, the stuff that brings it all together is, I would think, is the relationship. And I guess from a speech pathologist's perspective, you have to be assessing these bits.
Yeah.
But in the process of assessing those bits, something is lost in that relationship. Is that what?
Yes, that's exactly right. So it's kind of like that social component's lost.
Which is kind of why that's why we yarn.
Like, that's it. That's why we're putting the earth, aren't we? We're putting this earth so we can yarn, have a conversation and connect with people. But I think that kind of might get lost within an assessment or a therapy session.
Because I think about, like, I know different mob over time who you can yarn with them and they talk. And then we might enter a different space or it's seeing someone they don't know and they make up their mind, they don't say nothing, they jam up and you're like, who's this one making out they don't speak all of a sudden? Because it is about the relationship that, well, I'm going to talk to this one because I don't know who they are, where they come from, what our relationship is. So I guess I could see that, you know, if some of our kids going to encounter a speech pathologist to have their speech assessed, they might not represent themselves in the best way in terms of their ability to communicate.
Yeah.
Because that relationship is not.
Yeah.
Is that what you can get?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So when the kids and the families come in, we have these list of questions and things that we want to go through, and so you can tick them off without having that relationship with the child, without having the relationship with the family. And, you know, we're taught to establish rapport. So we establish rapport.
Rapport? What's rapport?
What's that big word? I don't know. So rapport is, it's, I think it's a, I might get myself in trouble here, but it might, I think it's kind of superficial.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a true relationship. So a rapport is to make people feel comfortable, I guess. So,
so rapport is like gammon
rapport.
Relationship.
Yeah, that's what I reckon, but I'm probably going to get in trouble from the speeches now. Whereas we talk about relations, relationships and those connections. So, you know, you can have a chat with someone, but you don't necessarily know who they are.
Mm.
But if you have a yarn with someone, then you have to have that deep and meaningful connection with that person. You've got to know where their place is. You've got to know your place to be able to connect with that person.
Mm.
And I think with rapport, you can just fuzz over all of that. You don't have to give any personal information about yourself or expect anything else other than the questions that come to you that you've got to ask the families.
Mm.
So I think if, you know, a speechies, we develop relationships rather than rapport, we'd probably understand the person and the family that are coming into our sessions a bit more.
Yeah, and you might get some more from the family.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at even this show every day. Guests come on and the first question is, okay, who's your mob? Locate yourself. Tell us about it. You've got kids. Who, you know,
yeah.
It is about actually getting to know you first and then to know how we're going to yarn.
Yeah.
And every single presenter here does that every day, and we do it all the time, going, well, what's your last name and who's, where'd you grow up? And we've got to be able to know how to relate to each other in order to then... communicate. Yeah, it's kind of just, we just take it for granted. That's what you do.
Mm, I think so, yeah.
But for speech pathologists, their disciplinary training tells them that you do that gammon rapport thing.
It's about keeping your professional boundaries too, isn't it?
Oh,
I think as health practitioners, I think you're taught that. You don't give any personal information. You're here to do your job and you got to do your job. And, you know, there are days when I'm supposed to be seeing a kid for speech or language or whatever, but I don't do it that day because there are other things going on. But if I didn't know that family, if I didn't have that relationship with that family, then I wouldn't know what else was going on with them, so I wouldn't be able to support them in the other ways.
True. It's a very Western thing, this idea of dissecting ourselves from each other, as though we don't have this connection. It seems to be in a lot of health science, the health, you know, disciplines, a lot of professions, there's this talk about the professional boundaries and distance and all that kind of stuff. And I know whenever we get health professionals working in Indigenous-specific services, we have to train that out of them and go, you realise when you come and work in a black service, then I'm going to ask you who you are, you've got to have to tell them about yourself. You can't be this sort of... you know, outsider. You're either in or you're not, you know, that, yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Interesting. Okay, we're going to talk a bit, we're going to cut to a break, but we're going to talk after this about yarning and Aboriginal English and talk some more about our way of communicating.
You're tuned to Let's Talk, a weekly current affair program hosted by First Nations people for First Nations peoples. This is Chelsea Bond with Let's Talk.
Thank you for joining Let's Talk today. We are very pleased to have Miss Tara Lewis on as our guest. As part of a segment we're having each month, profiling a PhD student. Tara is a speech pathologist undertaking a PhD. Are you watching the second year of your PhD?
Yeah.
So what next year are you going to be Dr. Lewis?
Year after.
Awesome. So we're talking about Aboriginal home language, Indigenous ways of communicating, and I thought it would be appropriate, given we are yarning now, to talk about yarning and what it is and what you reckon it is.
Well, we were talking before around having connections and relationships with people. So I think yarning, to me, is around that two-way sharing of stories. So it's around those lived experiences that, you know, people have and sharing those stories with each other. Because I think when I sit down with my elders... they tell me stories about the old days, about the mission, you know, the mission bell and having to be have a curfew of, you know, have to be home in their house by 6 o'clock or whatever. So it's around those lived experiences and those stories that are being shared, which I think continue the cultural learnings and our ancestral histories and teach us around our ways of knowing, being and doing.
Mm. It's interesting with the term yarning, because it's not an Aboriginal language word. It's an English word that has a distinctly Indigenous meaning. And if, so if you look in the dictionary, I think the dictionary definition of yarning, of yarn, is a fanciful story, an embellished story. So spin your yarn, and it's so in the, I guess, mainstream, yarn has a meaning that is very different to how Indigenous people think about yarn. So when I think about, you know, going for a yarn, having yarn with someone or yarning up, it's not a fanciful story, although sometimes they are. But it's in the Western sense, it's seen as, you know, like a you're making out, you're spinning a yarn, you're telling a lie, you're sort of having a go kind of thing. For us, when we talk about yarning, for me, it implies intimacy of a relationship where you actually get to know people's stories, because the sharing of stories is something that is earned. And oftentimes health professionals don't realise this, that if you want information from people, you can't just take it. You've got to earn the right to know someone and to know their story. And if someone does take the time to share their story with you, then that's a privilege, that's an honour, and you should be grateful for that. Sometimes you meet health professionals, you go, oh, that one talked on, and the consult went too long and I had to wrap it up, and they don't appreciate the moment of the yarn, that if someone's given you that story, it's a gift, and you've got to give something back too. It's two-way.
Mm.
Also, it's a way of knowing. So I know, if, I think it was Ian Anderson once wrote about, you know, our ability to tell a story is earned by explaining our relationship to a story. So I can't get up and talk about, and I can't talk about speech pathologists because I'm not a speech pathologist. I have no relationship to that, what I'm going to talk about. So I can't talk about that stuff. And so this yarning for me is about also declaring your relationship to something. And if I know someone gets up and talks about a particular thing, I want to know first what their relationship is to that thing so I can trust them as a credible source. Well, of course they know because they've got this lived experience of it and they shared that lived experience of it. They're not just making out that they know something. So they have a relationship to the knowledge that you're sharing, and it's through the yarn you get to see that. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. Yep. Through all those stories, yeah.
And you hear them once go, oh, how would that one know? She don't know. if you don't do that, you know, like I did some work around smoking cessation. So I've got to declare my relationship with smoking and I've struggled with it and that kind of thing. And ordinarily a health professional will go, oh, well, you've been a smoker, so you can't do smoking stuff because you've been a smoker. And in our way, it's like, no, that's the best person to be doing smoking cessation, someone who actually has quit and navigated that because they have their relationship to that knowledge, that experience.
Yeah.
So it's not just us sitting around wasting time, telling fanciful stories. It's about relationship. It's about, you know, knowing, a way of knowing something.
Yeah. And through my focus groups as well, people have said it's a time to reset as well. So you go along on your busy day doing what you do, and then it's a time to come back to people that you are connected with and you have those relationships and to reset, to reconnect with people.
Yes.
And you talk about stories, and it's all through the stories.
I know there are some days at work where I might get caught up with lots of people coming in for yarn, and I get a bit anxious because I've got a lot of work on and I've got to come back on the weekend to catch up. But I know that was important for those yarns on that particular day. There was a reason why I had people come yarn about something and we had that yarn. So, yeah, that resetting thing, I hadn't thought about it like that.
And I think we do it with family too all the time, don't we? We go and reset. You know, you have a terrible day at work or something, and so then you've got to go reset and reconnect with people.
So you're trying to bring yarning into the assessment methodology. Is that what you're...
I'm trying to, yeah.
So do you reckon you can teach white fellas how to yarn?
Well...
Is that what you're trying to do or what?
Yeah, so I think so.
Can you teach yarning?
Well, I think we can teach people to bring their guards down, maybe.
Oh.
Maybe we can do that. Those professional boundaries, and we can talk about, you know, sharing some information about yourself.
Not oversharing, though.
No, there's, we don't need to overshare.
We don't know everything about our health professional because sometimes we don't want to know.
That's right. Yeah. But, I mean, I work with an OT and she's really good at yarning, so she'll get up there and she'll yarn with our families and she'll give information, share things about her. And, you know, like you said earlier, if we're expecting a client to share information, personal information about themselves, and we also need to share something about ourselves, so it feels like a safe place for our clients too.
Because, I mean, you think about, and this is not for speeches necessarily, but health professionals on any given consultation, the questions that they're required to ask are intrusive, invasive, and it's like, I'm going to tell this person my whole life, but I don't even know who they are and if I can trust them or tell them the truth.
Yep.
I knew of a dietitian who had come from private practice to work in an Indigenous service. And she was really clever because she discovered after a little while that her first consultation with clients in the Indigenous service would not be about giving health advice. It would be just yarning with them, getting to know them and building a relationship, because the dietitian you often see on a regular basis. So, you know, she had the time to be able to space that out. And, you know, people received that so well. They trusted her then to talk about some of the challenges that they were having around diet and household stuff. It just changed the nature of engagement, because what was privileged first was that relationship with Mob and going, I need to get to know this person before I can even think about telling them what to do.
That's right, yeah. And that may not be the first priority either. So coming into a speech session may not be the first thing that the family needs. Could be something else, but how do we know that if we're not connecting and building relationships with our families?
True. Yeah. The other thing I love about yarning is it's a really good way to share information or give advice. So sometimes I might have people ask me things and ask me what I think about this or that, and I won't tell them you should do this or you should do that. I'll tell them a yarn and go, well, I don't know, but I remember this one time, and you tell a little story and you let them take the story and take what they want to get from the story.
Yep.
And because this, you know, I feel that we can't always tell people you should do this and you should do that. And I know there are people who've done that for me who haven't told me what to do, but they shared a yarn with me and I meant to take something from that. And the other one is sometimes you have, like, the mole fellas, they tell the same yarn over and over and over again. But each time there's something different that we're, you know, there's a reason we're meant to hear that yarn and hear it again, because we must have
missed something.
I remember there was this one auntie, she was speaking at this thing, and I'd seen her a couple of weeks beforehand, and she kind of said to me, oh, look, I'm going to say that same thing I said last week. You were there. And she was sort of a bit apologetic about it. And then she went, oh, hang on. I guess with the oral history, we had to put things in stories so that we could remember them. And there's each story, every time you tell it, there's something different. So maybe you'll get something different from this one. I said, absolutely. So stories are really powerful.
They are, yeah. I love listening to our elders, the old ones, sit down and have any yarn with them. I learn something new every time. That's the thing about yarn too. I think maybe because, you know, growing up I was the youngest. So yarning for me was about learning too.
Listening, youngest got to listen.
Listen, you don't get to big time. Yeah. even with the older cousins, you know, growing up with them, they were always there. I don't remember a time sitting down with the adults when I was young. You know, when you're older,
so
you
the big
down.
People's table.
That's right.
You got chased outside.
That's right. But we didn't come back till, you know, it was dark. Well, not before. We had to come back before it was dark, because, you know, them juddies, they come get you. So, you know, all those stories that I learnt from my cousins too. So, you know, they were always there looking after me. So the yarns that I had with them is how I learnt about our culture and about our spiritual stories and the ways that we should be.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you get older, you talk to your elders and you learn about that history and you learn about how resilient and the opportunities that we have today is from all the struggles and everything that our elders have been through. So we need to take those opportunities. We need to keep going with it too.
It's really about sort of the moral lessons that you, that are contained within yarns. I don't know. I grew up going to Sunday school every Sunday, so the parable, you know, the story wasn't about the story. It was about the mess. There was a message being conveyed via that. And you know, I loved Dr. Seuss as a kid because you read Dr. Seuss books. There's not about necessarily the Yodel the Turtle and about turtles. It's about power, and you know there are messages contained within those stories that we're meant to get. So I love listening to yarns and trying to decipher what am I meant to learn from this story. There's a reason why I'm being shared this story. What is it I'm meant to learn? So even as a listener, when someone's yarning, you have to be active, like listen beneath the story, not just the surface level, hey?
Yeah, that's it, yeah. And all those Aboriginal stories too, they've got those meanings, those underlying meanings in them. It's really important.
Absolutely, all the creation stories about why the kangaroo got, how the kangaroo got its tail, there's a reason, a moral message around how we should behave, how we should conduct ourselves and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see what this work brings and how it might change the ways in which speech pathologists assess our kids. I think that's really exciting stuff.
Yeah, should be.
What's the journey been like for you as a, what, mum of three kids, doing a PhD? How are you coping on this journey?
Well, it's interesting.
Now she's making out.
It's tough. It can be tough at times. You know, you got your deadlines that you got to meet. You got these supervisors that are always down on you.
These deadly supervisors.
No, they are deadly. But, you know, I think having to manage family and work and the PhD was tricky. And I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to do my PhD full time, which meant I could not go to work all the time. So I still have some input with the Institute, which is really nice, but I can focus more on the PhD. And I've had some advice from one of my deadly supervisors.
I wonder who that could be.
And it's important to just have your time for your PhD. You know, you were saying that go to the library or something so you can just think about your work, and so when you're home, you are home, you're present. You're present with your family.
Because those kids need someone to feed them.
They do. And yarn, the biggest yarn is these three, seriously. And even Holly, two-year-old, want to have a big yarn with me. But and I think that's really important. So it's really nice to be able to have that separate time. But then, you know, when you need to do a lot of work too, then you know, can kind of encroach on that family time too sometimes. So it can be tough. But as I said earlier, it's not about those letters or anything. It's about making sure that our kids and my kids now, like I'm very personally invested in it because I want to make sure my kids and all the other Murray Aboriginal kids out there in Australia have the same opportunities as everyone else.
Absolutely. My twinnies have had to see a speech pathologist because they're fourth and fifth child, so they're a little bit neglected, bless them. But they, I mean, they could yarn with each other really well, but none of us could understand what they were saying. And, you know, for a number of years they were kind of like, what's it, like miming, like doing sign language with their own made-up sign language about when they wanted to communicate with us. But we've had encounters with speech pathologists, and some of the activities that get sent home, there are words that I don't even know. And so they've got these cards and they've got to read these words and pronounce them, and I've never even heard of these words before. And I'm like that's extreme. Like, that's not even, I don't even know a whole lot of people who would, I mean, I think my Australian English is pretty good. University educated, I think I would know some things. But it was just really bizarre that this five-year-old kid at Anala got these words that mother cousin doesn't even understand what. I couldn't guess, because you got to like guess, look at the picture and guess what the word is.
Yeah.
And I can't remember, they were that foreign. I can't even remember what they were. And it was just like, wow, that's.
Yeah. Well, we've got some resources from America and from England.
Oh, because there was kids, you know, in the snow and there was sleet and stuff, which, I mean, that wasn't the word I was referring to. I know what sleet is, but the five-year-old at Anala didn't know what sleet was because, but there were some really bizarre ones, and I was like, wow, I know I'm not stupid, but how's this
Yeah.
I mean, it was quite an obvious example of, wow, like, it's not even appropriate for Australian kids, some of these materials.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Let alone our black kids.
Yeah, that's it. They've got no idea what these words are. You don't know, I don't know. And no, then I have to remember it for next time, so you've got to make out that you've practiced for the week too.
Yes, mother doesn't always do her homework. Now, I think our time's only up, but I want to ask you one last question, which I'm not sure you have the answer to. So what are you going to do with this PhD? What happens when you finish this? What's the plan?
Does your thesis just get filed under in a cupboard, or anyone else read it?
I think other people may want to read it.
Well, I'm working with Speech Pathology Australia now, so which is really good because we're looking at our accreditation standards for universities, so making sure that our culture and our language is incorporated within the curricula.
Awesome.
At the university level. So I guess that's probably somewhere where I want to go with it, is to make sure that other speech pathologists across Australia understand the methodology that we're developing and really value Aboriginal language and support the continued home language use for Aboriginal kids. You know, the research is, you know, all the Aboriginal people who have been part of the research have said that learning standard Australian English is really important. And that's obviously for school success too. But mm-hmm. We want to make sure that our home language isn't disadvantaged at the same time as we're promoting the use of standard Australian English within schools and workplaces.
I just think it's really exciting that an Indigenous speech pathologist and mum of three is doing this work and engaging with Indigenous knowledges to develop better methodologies for assessing kids generally. I just want to say big congratulations to you for all the work that you've done, and we wish you all the best for the remainder of your PhD journey, and hopefully we'll have Dr. Tara Lewis on the show again in the near future.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tara.
You've been tuned to Let's Talk, highlighting the injustice from community to country, suburb to city, with a multitude of hosts, Bo Spearham, Carver Watson, the aunties Lilla Watson and Mary Graham, and Chelsea Bond. Weekday mornings from 9 till 10, it's Let's Talk, welcoming the continued sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country.